the perceptions of a Jivan Mukta are described very precisely in one or two sentences. With our present state of mind, it is not possible to understand what the perception of a Jivan Mukta could be. We can only have comparisons, illustrations, analogies, images, etc. But what actually it is not possible for us to understand. We may be under the impression that he sees God and does not see the world. This is the usual way of giving an opinion about the experiences of a Jivan Mukta. These are all our ways of looking at things and our ways of thinking. There is no such thing as seeing God and not seeing the world, etc. Such differences, such contrasts do not find a place in a vision which sees what truth is. There is a lot of controversy in the schools of thought as to whether the world is seen by the Jivan Mukta or not. It all depends upon what you mean by the world. He sees the world, yes, or he does not see the world. Both statements are correct. He sees the world as it really is, not as it appears to the senses, which are distorted in their structure. And so, our relative values should not be carried to this realm of universal perception. And it would be unbecoming on our part to weigh the experiences of the Jivan Mukta on the scale of our understanding. There is no world even now, and the question of seeing the world or does not see the world does not actually arise. Whatever is now there will be there even afterwards. Just because someone has changed his mind, the world is not going to be different. But the mind has gone to such an extent of discipline and change and transformation in itself that it will see the world in the way it has to be seen. The Upanishads are never tired of telling us that the correct way of perception is to perceive the self in things and not to see the form of things. This is exactly what he sees. To see the self in things is not to see a thing or to see an object. Even these analogies are inadequate. We cannot understand as to what it is to see a self in a thing. Again, we will be interpreting the self as something outside us to be seen with the eye of spiritual perception. It is nothing of the kind. So with this cautious background, we have to try to understand these very short definitions of the grand descriptions of the Jivan Mukta given these passages of the Upanishad. He does exactly what you do and what I do. There is no difference in his conduct. He may speak the same language, he may eat the same food, but he is not eating the food and he is not speaking. This is a difficult thing to understand, because these particular activities and particular modes of experience are generalized and universalized in his case, so that these particular things do not become any more an obstacle. They become an obstacle only when they are wrested out of their universal context and made one's own, mine own, your own, or something standing on its own legs independently of others. His actions are no actions, they are universal movements. and he does not think as I think or you think. It is just a thought, which includes every thought. It is the general substance of every kind of mind and thought. So the Upanishad says, he will be speaking, he will be laughing, he will be moving about, he will be enjoying from our point of view only. The question of enjoying or speaking or moving about does not arise for that which has no particularized consciousness either of space, time or movement. He will be practically speaking for the vision of other people just like anyone else. So you cannot find out who is a Jivanmukta, even if you look at him. You look like yourself only. But there will be a tremendous difference inside. The electrons are not seen with our naked eyes, but the microscope can see. You keep a solid object in front of you, and gaze at this solid object and keep also a very powerful microscope. You are also seeing the object, the microscope also is seeing the object. But the two instruments are seeing two different things altogether. What you see, the microscope does not see. And what the microscope sees, you do not see. But simultaneously, both are seeing the same thing. Now you are the person to judge whether it is what you see or whether what it sees, which is the correct thing. So this is to give you one example of how the world is. You are also seeing it and he also sees it, but he sees it differently and you see it differently because of the difference in the instrument of perception. And for him the instrument does not exist. He himself is the instrument. He has become that which he is seeing. And so it cannot be called seeing, but it is rather being. Yadvai tanna pashyati, paschanvai tanna pashyati. Seeing he does not see. It appears as he does not see because there is nothing outside him. And yet he sees everything because he is himself that. He cannot be conscious of the body. Nopajanam smaranidam shariram. He is not only in one body, he is in every body. Whatever you think is his thought. And whatever anybody thinks also is his thought only. So you cannot say whether he thinks or I think. The question does not arise there. The consciousness of a particular body does not arise because all the bodies are his. So the Upanishad says there is no awareness of a particular engagement in some individual body. Yatha prayogya acharane yukta eva meva. Ayam asmin sharire prano yuktaha. Just as two bulls may be yoked to drag a cart, this Supreme Self manifest as the prana is yoked to this cart of the body as it were. The bulls do not become one with the cart. They are different. Likewise is this prana or consciousness that is yoked to the body, it is not identical with this form of the body. Whatever the eye sees when it is cast into space is something different in the case of this liberated soul from what our naked eyes see. In fact, in the case of the eyes perceiving something outside from the point of view of the liberated soul, it is not the eye that is seeing the object, it is something else that sees. This was the great point which was in the mind of Prajapati when he told Virochana and Indra that whatever is reflected in the eye is the Atman. So he was right in that. But these people could not understand what his intention was. What sees through the eye is not the eye. It is something different from the eye. And what hears through the ear too is not the ear that hears, but there is something else inside which hears through the ears. So is the case with every other sense organs. The senses do not contact the object. Who contacts the objects is somebody else. Utilizing these senses as instruments.
Atha yatra etat akasham anuvishannam chakshuhu sa chakshushah purusha darshanaya chakshuhu.
This eye is only an instrument of perception. What sees an object is not the eye. And what sees through the eye is the same thing as that which hears through the ear. The eye cannot hear, the ear cannot see. There is a distinction among the functions of the different senses. But you know very well that you can integrate these perceptions into a single whole, so that one individual being is aware simultaneously that there is perception, hearing, etc. Here in our case it is only an inference, but in the case of the liberated soul it is an actual realization. It is not merely that, there is something deeper than this implication. What sees through the eye also is different from the eye, and what is seen through the eye also is different from the object. It is not the eye that sees, and it is not the object that is seen. It is something else that is seen and something else that sees also, in the case of this liberated soul. The seen and the seer become one here. It is as if one thing is beholding itself.
Yaha Veda Idam Vijigraniti Sa Atma.
It is the Atman that smells, not the nose. Gandhaya Granam. The nose or the instrument of smelling is only a vehicle utilized by this consciousness for this purpose.
Yo Veda Idam Abhi Vyaharaniti Sa Atma Abhi Vyaharaya Vat.
The one that speaks is not the tongue. It is the Atman that speaks, utilizing the instrument of the tongue as merely an occasion for its manifestation in that particular manner.
Yo Veda Idam Shravanaiti Sa Atma Shravanaya Shrotra.
So is the case with the ear. The ear is only an occasion for the manifestation of the Atma. It is a single, all-pervading being which works in these diverse ways in the form of sense perception. So there is no such thing as sense perception. It is the Atman projecting itself in every nook and corner through these orifices called the senses, and contacting its own universal body outside, we wrongly call the objects of sense.
Atha ya veda, yo veda idam manvaniti sa atma. Manaha asya daivam chakshuhu sava esha etena daivena chakshusha manasa etan kaman pashyan ramate ya ete brahma loki.
Whatever thinks through the mind also is the Atma. The so-called mind is only a cognitive instrument. But it is a superior kind of instrument. It is a celestial eye provided to us.
In fact, in Brahmaloka it is said that the mind only works, the senses do not exist.
These manifestations in five ways, as seeing, hearing, etc., do not come into operation in Brahmaloka. The great souls living in Brahmaloka do not see with the eyes, do not speak with the tongue, they do not eat as we do, they merely exist in their mental body. There are some who even think that the mind also does not work there in the ordinary way. It is something aprakrita or super-physical
and non-material substance that becomes the vehicle for the experience of souls in Brahmaloka. This celestial eye, which comprehends all things at one stroke, not like the senses which perceive only one thing at a time, this instrument is that which is used in Brahmaloka. The moment such a mind thinks, the whole conglomeration of objects connected with that thought appear at one stroke there in the presence of that individual. Manasa etan kaman pashyan ramati yaiti brahmaloki. The archetypes of things are perhaps visualized in Brahmaloka, not the reflections. These objects which we see in this world are not originals, they are only reflections. The originals are in Brahmaloka, including myself and yourself. We are all reflections of an original, which do not exist in this world. So we are all unreal bodies, apparitions in some respect, looking like very important persons. Our importance is somewhere else, which is rooted in a higher realm. And we are even now connected with that realm. Our legs are there, though we appear to be moving here. So this is the meaning of an archetype, the original. We are reflected and therefore distorted, hence partial and finite, and on account of which we are incapable of fulfilling our desires. The original alone can work, the in-reflection cannot work as efficiently as the other ones. This efficiency comes only when you reach Brahmaloka. Now this Brahmaloka does not mean some other world which is several millions of miles away. It is a state of consciousness. It is inside this hall itself. It is not outside. It is the high frequency of consciousness. That is called Brahmaloka, into which one can raise oneself even here. And there is no question of here and there. These are only inappropriate terms in connection with the experience. Neither here nor there, nor then nor now. All these words cannot apply there. Wherever you are, there is Brahmaloka. If only you can tune up your mind to the high frequency of this level, which is called Brahmaloka. Tam va etam devaha atmanam upasate. The great gods contemplate this Atma. Having Indra as their leader, who obtained this superior initiation from Prajapati, in the manner mentioned here. Therefore, they are able to fulfill all their wishes by mere thought. To an account of the contact they establish with their inner mind, in respect of everything that they think at any moment of time. देवाः आत्मानम् उपासते तस्मात् तेषां सर्वे च लोकाः आत्ताः. All the worlds are comprehended by them. They can penetrate through walls. Objects like a huge mountain cannot impede their movement. Physical bodies are no obstacles. We sometimes hear in scriptures that angels fly. Gods can move from place to place, because they are mental bodies, they are not physical vehicles. So they are not controlled by the power of the gravitation of the earth. And so everything is under their sway. They can have entry into every realm. They can move anywhere. All desires of theirs are fulfilled on account of this impervious consciousness, which itself is not capable of being obstructed by anything else. Sarve cha kamaha sa sarvamscha lokana pramati sarvamscha kaman yastam atmanam anavidya vijanati. This is a glorification of the knowledge of the Atman, not only in respect of the gods who had this through Indra, But it is a knowledge which can be had by anyone, including yourself and myself and all. It is not a prerogative of any particular person or individual. Everyone is a parent to this great knowledge, provided the same discipline is undergone. You can imagine what hardship Indra had to pass through. Perhaps our hardships will be much more. And so one has to be prepared for paying the price of this knowledge. Then naturally it shall come. It is the property of everyone. But one has to be ready for being a receptacle of this knowledge. Then, as is the case with all those who have realized the self, so will be the case with everyone who has this knowledge. That is, complete control over things and the fulfillment of everything whichever wish arises in the mind at that very moment. This is what Prajapati said in conclusion. Prajapati Ruvacha. This analysis of the various states of consciousness through the instrumentality of the story of instruction of Indra by Prajapati. These analyses are actually the logical approaches by way of inference to the existence of a deep consciousness in every one of us. What Prajapati actually wanted to drive home into the mind of the disciple was that the Atman is ubiquitously present everywhere in all the three states. That's why he said sometimes it is in the eye, sometimes in the dream state, sometimes he said it's sleeping condition, and at other times he said it is something transcendent. Now all these definitions are correct, though we should not take them literally. The implication or the actual intention behind the instruction has to be taken. The Atman is in sleep, it is true, it is in dream, it is also in waking, it is reflected through the eyes and the senses. All these statements are correct, because without the operation in some way of the nature of this consciousness, there would be neither sleep, nor dream, nor waking. But there is a compartment, as it were, introduced by us into these various experiences so that we are unable to connect the deeper implications of these different experiences. When we are in one condition, we completely forget the other condition. When we are awake, we cannot be dreaming. When we dream, we cannot be sleeping. When we sleep, we cannot be awake. So this is our difficulty. In spite of the fact, it is one and the same substratum that is responsible for all these experiences. The difference arises on account of a peculiar faculty in us called the mind. It is not the defect of consciousness. It is the same that is in me and in you and in the Jivanmukta. This so-called mind is also an inscrutable something. We can't understand what it is. It is a finitizing agent. It is a kind of focusing of consciousness in respect of some location. That is called the mind. It is not an independent thing, absolutely different from the Atman. We can't say exactly what its relation is to the Atman. It is a hybrid, as it were, born from one side partially and belonging to another side partially. However, for practical purpose of analysis, we may say it is the same consciousness that we call the Atman, somehow or other got twisted and focused in a particular given direction so that it gets obsessed with the view that direction alone is real and every other direction does not exist. This obsessed movement of the mind in respect of a particular direction is what we call its target or the object of sense. This is a creation of its own due to its own prarabdha. We can't say how it works. But the background is the same. It does not vary. The mind in waking, the mind in dream, the mind in sleep. And the mind that has transcended itself. All these are basically pervaded through and through, warp and woof by the same consciousness. The feeling that I exist in the waking state is due to the Atman in me. Otherwise, that feeling cannot be. This existence aspect of the feeling that I exist is the Atman speaking in its own language. This feeling is persisting even in dream. And you cannot say even in sleep that you did not exist. So it was there. Not only that, it exists as a self-sufficient awareness. We are aware in one way in the waking state, we are aware in a different way altogether in the other two states. There is a difference in the structure of the awareness because of the difference in the nature of the objects with which this particular compartmentalized consciousness is connected. So we get shifted wholly due to our affiliation with the mind to these realms in which the mind moves, and then it is that we are unable to connect the one phase of the consciousness with another phase. So Prajapati's instruction is a universal instruction that the Atman is present in every state. Even in the unconscious state it is there. The unconsciousness is not of the Atman. It is of the mind. It is a kind of stifling taking place in the finitude of individuality. The finitizing principle, we call the mind, gets suffocated, as it were. It closes its eyes in sleep, in coma, and even in death, in states of unconsciousness, which cannot be attributed to the Atman. So, this is the difficulty with us. And this transcendent state, which the great master Prajapati speaks of as bodiless, free from embodiment, is capable of being attained, as is pointed out by the Upanishad, by means of certain disciplines. But we are not told as to what these disciplines are. We have been told Brahmacharya, but we cannot understand what it means. 32 years, 5 years, 101 years, it means 1,000 years. But what was it that he did for these years? Was he merely having his breakfast and lunch in the hotel of Brahma and getting on there? It was not like that. There must have been something very strange in the way of life he lived there. The inklings of which we can get from the way in which students lived in ancient masters' hermitages and conducted themselves wholly and solely for the purpose for which they came. There should be a complete channelization of our aspirations in the direction for which we come to the masters. There should be no distraction of aim or purpose. The discipline that is spoken of in the Upanishad is nothing but a channelization of consciousness. You may call it Brahmacharya, you may call it self-control, you may call it anything. It is a concentration of the entire being of yours in a given direction, so that it does not move in any other direction. It is like an arrow moving towards its target, and it will not be aware of anything else either this way or that way. This arrow consciousness is what is expected of us, and we shall not budge until the goal is reached. We are told of this sort of attitude of mind even in the case of recent comparatively personalities like Buddha and others who budge not from the aim which was given to their minds from their own point of view. Modern times are unfit for these disciplines, as is well known to us. We have problems and problems. But the wisdom lies not in merely saying that there is a problem. There were problems perhaps even to those people. But in finding ourselves in the proper place, we should not misplace ourselves in unsuited contexts. We have to rise from the level in which we are, whatever the level be. It may be a child's level or adult's level or a mature mind's level. It may be an official's level. It may be a student's level. It may be a professor's level. Each one should be able to judge for himself or herself where one stands and what is the context in which one is placed in the atmosphere of the aspiration which one entertains in one's mind. What are the problems? We are told that the great Ramatirtha had a peculiar technique of his own, of self-control. He used to make a list of all the desires. And here, it was not merely a joke that he was making. It was an honest investigation into one's own mind. To some extent, one can know what are our desires. You go to a corner, you sit in your room and sit behind the temple or in the forest and think as to what are your desires. You should not say, I have no desires. Nor can you say, I do not know anything. You know something. Because the persistent thoughts in the mind are our desires. When you are free from the distractions of the daily vocation of life, your real desires will manifest themselves. These desires have to be dealt with in a proper manner. That is nothing but the discipline called for. The discipline or brahmacharya which the Upanishad speaks of is the discipline of the desire. What are you going to do with your desires? Are you going to swallow them or oppose them, you crush them or fulfill them? You can't answer these questions easily. This is the reason why a superior person's guidance is necessary. These desires are like snakes. You cannot touch them. You cannot keep them lie down there in a corner. You can't do anything with them. But you can't keep quiet also. You know very well the nature of these snakes. So, a very dexterous method has to be employed, and that is the discipline. Neither subjugating nor crushing, nor fulfilling in the literal sense, but tackling them in the manner they should be tackled under the circumstances in which you are placed, considering the strength and weakness of your mind and the consequences also of your action. So many factors have to be considered. All this one individual cannot do. And therefore a guru is necessary. So thus is the little bit of meandering we do in respect of the subject of this Upanishad, to whose conclusion we are gradually approaching. श्यामाच्छबलं प्रपद्ये शबलाच्छ्यामं प्रपद्ये अश्व इव रोमाणि विधूय पापं चंद्र इव राहोः मुखाद् प्रमुच्य धूत्वा शरीरं अकृतं कृतात्मा ब्रह्मलोकं अभिसंभवामीति अभिसंभवामीति. You are about to enter into the realm of Brahma. the aspiration has gone to its apex. So the soul speaks to itself as it were, I shall reach that supreme state. Literally translated, these words mean, from the dark blue one, I go to the more defined one. Nobody knows what these words mean if you try to understand them merely grammatically. The commentators say these words refer to the states of supreme experience. Various commentators have many different things to tell. From the cause I go to the subtle, from the subtle I go to the cause. From Ishvara I go to Hiranyagarbha, from Hiranyagarbha I go to Ishvara. Or from Brahman I go to Ishvara, or from Ishvara I go to Brahman. From the universal I go to the cause thereof, and from the cause I go to the universal. All these are exclamations in joy of the soul that is about to enter into the ocean of being. And how do I go to this tremendous experience? I shake off my whole body and clean it up as a horse does by shaking off its body and throwing down all the dust from its hairs. This is not a literal shaking off of the physical body, but a shaking off of the entire vestures of personality. Annamaya, pranamaya, manomaya, vijnanamaya, anandamaya, the five koshas, the physical body, the vital, the mental, the intellectual and the causal. All these bodies are shed automatically, dust like I throw them. And I shall free myself as if moon is getting freed from the clutches of eclipse. The darkness of the eclipse is going and the moon is freed from this darkness of grahana, Rahu, as it is called here. So shall I be freed from the clutches of ignorance, this darkness that has been overshadowing me up to this time. I shall shake off this body, which is actually not there. I have been misled into the feeling that it was there. So I shall free myself from this obsession to the feeling that the body is there. I shall become a kritatma, one who has fulfilled his purposes. The aim of life has been attained. All my purposes have been fulfilled. There is nothing left to be done now. Because that which is the ultimate purpose of all other efforts and endeavors in life has been reached. I shall attain the Brahmaloka, the supreme abode of the Creator. I shall reach this abode and become one with this abode. Brahmalokam abhisambhavamiti, abhisambhavamiti. Even comparatively later mystics have spoken about experiences of this kind. The great saints of India like Saint Ramadas, Tukaram, Janeshwar Maharaj, and in the West mystics like Plotinus have explained, without always using the word Brahmaloka, of course, that in this supernal experience there is a consciousness of the interpenetration of things. And in the world of Plotinus particularly, everything is mirrored in everything else. It is as if everywhere you have got only mirrors to which the individuals are compared. Not physical mirrors, of course, kept in space, but non-located superphysical mirrors, if at all you can call them such, where every individual is reflected in every other individual, everything is everywhere. This is the experience of interpenetration in Brahmaloka. To such I go. Akasho vai nama rupayoho nirvahita te yadantara tad brahma tad amurtam sa atma. This space that you see here is the cause of the differentiation of name and form. What you call the objects of sense are nothing but names and forms. They have been manifest on account of the presence of space and time. But what is inside space? That is the absolute. You can see space, but you cannot see what is inside space. That which is internal to even the subtlest object of perception, which is space, that is the Atman, that is the Brahman, the absolute. Tad Brahma. Tadamrutam, this is the immortal. Prajapate sabham veshma prapadye. Now there is the exclamation of the liberated soul. This is the Atman, this is the Brahman. For the sake of this realization, I enter the hall, the abode of Prajapati the Creator. In some Upanishads like the Kaushitaki, we have very beautiful descriptions, very realistic explanations of what things are met on the way by the soul in its ascent to Brahmaloka. I enter the hall of Brahma. I go to the abode of Prajapati, the Creator. I become the glory of everyone. Your glory and my glory, all glories are single. Because I enter into everyone. Whatever is the greatness of anything, that becomes my greatness. Yashoham bhavami brahmananam yasho rajnam yashodvisham brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, kings, rich people, great men, geniuses, masters, scientists, artists, whoever they be, whatever greatness they have, it is my greatness. Because I enter into their souls. I get united with their being. And whatever they are, that I myself am. That is my glory. Aham anuprapatsi. I attain to everything. Sahaham yashasam yashaha. I am the glory of all glories. What is the glory of the glorious people in this world? That has come from something else. That itself am I. May I not enter into this womb of the mother once again is the last prayer of the liberated soul. He shall not enter into the womb of the mother. Shvetam adatkam, adatkam, shvetam lindumabhigam, lindumabhigam. These peculiar words mean, may I not enter into the womb of the mother which swallows all souls into their embodiment and limits them into personality. This is the great wisdom of the Chandogya Upanishad in its quintessence. This is what the great creator Brahma spoke to his children, who are called the Prajapatis, Marichi, Atriya, Kashyapa, Angirasa, etc. This knowledge has come by Guru Parampara gradually. There were no books, and books do not give the knowledge. From year to year, knowledge has been communicated. Brahma spoke to Prajapatis. Here too, there is a difference of opinion in regard to the interpretation of the meaning. What is Brahma, what is Prajapati? The Supreme Brahman spoke to Prajapati or the Creator. Hiranyagarbha, Brahma. Narayana spoke to Brahma, as we hear it in the Srimad Bhagavata, for instance. Or, according to Shankaracharya, who is the commentator of the Upanishad, Brahma, the Creator, Prajapati, spoke to Kashyapa and other progenitors of the family of the universe. And these Prajapatis spoke to Manu, the first man, the Adam of our creation. Then Manu gave this knowledge to all the subjects. So it has gradually come stage by stage from guru to disciple to us. This knowledge has come. But how has it come? How does it come? It comes through once being prepared for the reception of this knowledge by way of the discipline mentioned. And what are these disciplines? That is mentioned in a few words in these sentences to which we shall revert later. Hari Om Tat. Prajapati gave this wisdom to his progeny, and then gradually it has come down to the level of all the devotees, disciples and seekers through the chain of gurus, guru parampara as we call it. In this concluding passage of the Upanishad, we are given an advice that for the sake of this knowledge, one has to dedicate the whole of one's life in a highly disciplined manner. This vocation, if you would like to call it, is not going to be one of the many other activities in life. It is a whole-souled aspiration. And so, it calls for an application of every faculty of ours in a completely dedicated manner. What we call the usual stages of life, the ashramas, Brahmacharya, Garhasthya, Vanaprastha and Sannyasa stages are hinted at in this passage as the requisite processes through which one passes for the maturity of one's mind. And at the same time, the caution is administered that the whole of one's life has to be lived in such a way that it is a preparation for the spiritual goal. There is often a misconception that the spiritual part of one's life is sannyasa, and the earlier three stages are not. This is what will be refuted by all the Upanishads. The stages of life right from Brahmacharya onwards are preparations for spiritual life. Rather, they are necessary stages in one's ascent to the spiritual goal. It is not that the spiritual life commences only from sannyasa and abruptly, as it were, while the earlier parts are disconnected entirely from the spiritual goal. The whole of one's life from birth to death is a spiritual preparation. There is nothing but spirit in life, and therefore no activity can be entirely secular in the sense of its being bereft of the awareness of God's presence as one's goal of life. In India particularly, we have what are called samskaras, the various ceremonies symbolic of the affiliation of every stage of one's life to the spiritual goal. There is no such thing as an unspiritual aspect of life. Even if it is brahmacharya or the life of a householder or a vanaprastha. So this is a very interesting and a very important advice. By which what we are told is the whole of life of a person, whichever be that person, is an entirely dedicated schooling, as it were, a period of training for the purpose of this final achievement. There is no part of life which can be squandered or wasted or completely cut off from this consciousness of the ideal of one's life, not even childhood. Even that has to be associated by proper means. The moment consciousness becomes self-conscious, even in a youngster. Acharya kulat veda madhitya. The traditional method is mentioned. You get admitted into the Gurukula of the Acharya, of the Guru, the sacred training ground is called the Gurukula, the abode of the Guru, the atmosphere of a spiritual teacher. There one studies the Vedas. The Vedas are not studied as we are accustomed to study them these days. It is not merely a parrot-like chant of the words of the Veda without knowing what it means. The study of the Veda is an imbibing of knowledge, not merely a committing to memory of the words of the scripture. And the Veda does not mean merely one thing, it means many things. Anantavai Vedaha, says an old adage. The Veda is a name given to the repository of all comprehensive knowledge. And it has various stages and aspects of approach. Very few people have time enough to comprehend everything that is in the Veda. Mostly they are introduced into certain shakha, certain sections, certain parts only, and all of them cannot be studied. And even if all the shakhas or sections of the Veda are taught, everything that is contained in them cannot be absorbed into one's mind. However, this is a very necessary stage of training, the study of the Veda. Yatha vidhanam guroho karma adisheshena abhisamat vrittya. This is another important advice here, which is likely to miss the attention of ordinary people. The study under a preceptor should be done during the period of time which one has apart from the time he spends for the service of the Guru. It does not mean that he will be studying from morning to evening, sitting with a book and completely ignoring his duty of service to the Guru. His principal duty is service to the Guru, study is secondary, and the study is undergone only at other times, the time of recess as it were, which he can acquire after he has completed his duty towards his Guru. Having undergone this training for the required period with a Guru, one enters the household usually. Kutumbe shujau deshe swadhyaya madhiyanaha dharmikan vidadhat atmani sarvendriyani sampratishthapya. The life of a householder is not one of distracted secular activity. It is not the opposite of sannyasa, as people think usually. It is one step leading to sannyasa and the most mature part of one's life. There, one's obligations are manifold. As a matter of fact, it is the most difficult part of one's life. Since there is a concentration of obligation and duty in the stages of brahmacharya, vanaprastha and sannyasa, there is a manifoldness of duty enjoined upon the householder, and his difficulties are much more, and therefore the training that he undergoes in that period is more effective, a greater preparation, as it were, than in any other stages. Having settled in a proper household, after this period of training is over under a guru, one should find time to be seated in a holy or sacred place and continue the study and not forget the study. Because the study is the art of keeping the mind abreast with the consciousness of the goal of life. Else you will forget everything. Though you have studied something in earlier days, now you would have forgotten all things and the mind may get rusted. Swadhyaya is a perpetual necessary training for everyone, which is not actually the process of acquiring new knowledge, but a way of keeping the mind aware always of what it has studied and the way of applying this knowledge in practice for the great goal. So Swadhyaya is a permanent requisite. Always you have to be studying these great texts, lest you should forget your goal. Dharmikan vidadhat. If one is a householder, he has, of course, virtuous children, or he has virtuous disciples. Who will receive this knowledge from him? Under whom they will undergo this kind of training? And thus, he fulfills his obligation as a householder for the period required. Then he withdraws his senses. That is the stage of Vanaprastha. Sarvendriyani sampratishthapya. Atmani. All the activities get centered in the self when the senses are withdrawn. Instead of external activity, there is internal activity afterwards. A psychological function replaces all the external duties, the sacrifices, the panchamahayajnas, the various services that he was rendering outwardly in the world previously, now become the responsibilities of his life in an internal world of self-control, withdrawal of the senses. Ahimsan sarvahutani. The great vow of the sannyasini is, he never harms anyone. Abhayam sarvahute bhyamattav sarvam pravartave. Is the great fearlessness that he extends to all living beings. You will not be afraid of seeing a sannyasin, that he will do harm or do something bad, because his heart has expanded beyond the limits of his body and family. Anyatra tirthebhya. There is a term here which means it would be difficult to extend this obligation of ahimsa or non-injury in an unconditional manner. Obviously, as it were, on account of the fact that we live in a world. Various interpretations have been offered for this particular phrase, anyatra tirthebhya. The usual meaning would be the sacrificial note of the Brahmanas of the Veda, that the committing of himsa is forbidden everywhere except in prescribed places or prescribed occasions. Well, the more generous interpretation of it, as is offered by many other commentators, is that the prescribed occasions are those terms or periods of activity when you are likely to commit some kind of harm to creatures inadvertently, as it were. It is not possible to live a life of such an extreme type of ahimsa on account of our not being aware many a time as to what we are doing. Of course, the intention is not that you should consciously do any harm. Unconsciously, harm is done. This is done particularly by the householders, because of their living in a house, having kitchen with fireplace, water place, grinding place, etc., etc., where insects, etc., are likely to be crushed, killed, even inadvertently. And various other occasions are there in life, which cannot be recounted here, when you are likely to cause an unconscious harm to living beings. These, of course, are excluded, since they are unconsciously done, but they can be expiated by the intense sadhana which the sannyasin is expected to perform in the purely internal spiritual life that he lives as meditation proper. Sakhalu evam vartayan yavadayusham. Whole of one's life should be lived like this. The moment you become conscious of the goal of your life, then it is up to you to see that every activity of yours is somehow or other reconciled with this goal. It should not be an incompatible thing that you are doing against your own conscience and against the purposes that you have on hand. Thus it is that it is necessary to have the entire life of one's transformed into a spiritual art. Often it is said that the last thought is the determining factor of one's future fate. The last thought that may come to the mind at the time of death is the fruit of this tree of the long life that we have lived in this world. You know very well that the fruit cannot be different from the nature of the tree. So last thought cannot be something quite contrary to or different from the various impressions produced in the mind by the continuous thoughts that it was entertaining throughout one's life. Hence, if one has to have this spiritual ideal maintained in one's consciousness even at the time of departing, then it has to be maintained as a discipline throughout one's life. Yavad ayusham vartayan brahma lokam abhisampabadye. Thus one reaches the great abode of the creator, brahma loka, and then there is no return. Once you go there, you will not come back. Though this is very frightening to many people, that you don't come back. It is as if it is a lion's den. We need not enter into this subject because it looks very funny that after studying the whole Upanishad, you have a fear that God will swallow you and you will have no occasion to come back. The question of coming back does not arise because you become one with the universal reality. This going and coming are only ways of speaking. It is actually an attunement of the consciousness with the all being, the absolute. Here we have concluded the study of the Chandogya Upanishad. We commenced somewhere from the 5th chapter, and we have completely omitted all the chapters right from the beginning till the end of the 4th. The reason being that there is not much of a philosophical or mystical or religious substance except symbolic contemplations and meditations in the earlier chapters. However, I thought before concluding, I shall take up 2 sections from the earlier portions which are of some importance. At least they are interesting, though they are not going to tell you something new. And these 2 sections deal with what are called the Shandilya Vidya and the Samvarga Vidya.